Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Always look forward to having my colleague Mona Charon as a guest on the show. Mona, good morning. How are you?
Thanks, Charlie. I always look forward to it, too.
Mona, I have to warn you.
Okay, I'm ready.
The NSA is listening to this podcast. In fact, they have listened to every one of our podcasts. They are tapping our phones. They actually know what I'm going to ask you before I ask you. I think they have implants in my brain. Okay, so
if we speak very quietly,
it doesn't help.
Won't be able to hear us.
No, I don't think that. See, here's the problem, Mona. I guess, you know, I was thinking about this yesterday, that if I said some batshit crazy stuff like that, people would go, "Oh man, that's Sykes. He's an idiot. He's a moron." I mean, it would just
right.
it would be the kind of thing that for most people, if you say stuff like that, they wrap you in a white sheet and they take you away, right? They don't.
Or, you know, you smile politely as your eyes dart back and forth, thinking, "Where are the exits?"
Well, exactly, and this is. You know, part of me sort of admires admires the world that Tucker Carlson has created himself. I mean, it's a consequence-free zone. He can get away with anything. He can say things that are just, whether they're racist or they're just flat-out lies or they're just crazy. And everybody kind of knows they're crazy, but he's Tucker Carlson and there are no consequences.
Well, and he has a playbook he's following. I mean, remember early in the Trump presidency, the famous tweet about Obama tapped my wires or whatever he said, right? Yeah. And I had the exact same reaction you're describing, sort of like, oh my God, he's really losing it now. He's off into crazy talk. And of course, his audience believed it, thought it was fine, and there were no negative consequences, probably only positive ones for him indulging in this fantasy. And so, you know, Tucker, who was, as we all know, you know, a reasonable, rational person in the past, has now sort of said, okay, I guess crazy is the way we roll now. And so he's doubling down on it.
But let me make a confession here. My lizard brain is actually getting tired. And my lizard brain is, this is the part of my brain that I use to understand what's going on. Because, you know, it's kind of like a Rosetta Stone. How do you interpret what, you know, my pillow guy is saying or what Charlie Kirk is saying or what the orange guy is saying? So it's my, you know, if you tap into your lizard brain, and everybody has one, you kind of can understand where they're going and why they're saying what they're saying, but it's been taxed. It has been. I what's interesting about this particular thing about the NSA is number one, Fox News itself is not covering the story at all. Have you noticed some of your former colleagues at National Review are going, well, how do we know it's not true? And this is the thing about stuff like that. It's not falsifiable. The NSA issues a statement saying they're not doing it. And everybody's going, but, you know, it could happen. And so it's out there. So speaking of lizard brain update.
Yeah.
And how the crazy spreads. My pillow guy is going to end up in a ward somewhere. I'm sorry. I mean, this guy is just, he's out there. But he continues to be, quote unquote, taken seriously by people with access to power. I mean, he has that crazy rally in New Richmond, Wisconsin. And Donald Trump, who, believe it or not, was the former president of the United States. Five years later, it's still hard to get your head around that. Shows up, I mean, he appears via Jumbotron. To give some sort of cover to what Mike Lindell is saying. And Mike Lindell is also now being touted by Steve Bannon, who we can all roll our eyes about this, but Steve Bannon has a constituency out there on the right, people who take this seriously. And can I just play a little soundbite from this is Steve Bannon talking to Mike Lindell and talking about how the big state wants to shut down Mike Lindell and the lawsuit against Mike Lindell for lying about Dominion voting systems is pretty much exactly what Adolf Hitler and the Nazis did in 1930. Okay, so we are back to it's Hitler, it's Dominion voting system, the government. Hitler, Mike Lindell. I don't know who he's supposed to be in this scenario, but he's on his way to the death camps. You think I exaggerate? Here is Steve Bannon.
This case speaks to something that's much larger than Mike Lindell and MyPillow.
Big.
What this is trying to show, it's trying to shut up the business community and businessman to say, hey, if you raise your voice, if you try to have any opinion at all, we're going to come and sue you. And most business people are going to sit there and calculate, hey, you know what? The legal is going to cost me this. I'm going to lose customers. I'm going to do it. I got to focus on the business. They're just going to shut up. This is to get people to shut up and just go along. This is how, hey, look back in the 1930s. Don't take it from Steve Bannon. Read the history of the 1920s and 1930s. I'm going to pick a random case. In Nazi Germany.
Yep, random.
Just look at the business community. Look what happened. If you continue to look the other way and shut up, then the oppressors, the authoritarians get total control and total power.
Right, absolutely.
Okay? Just read the history of this. That's what this case is about. This case is they wanted Mike Lindell to shut up, and they went to the heart of where he got his resources, MyPillow. Is that not right? Yep. This is really, they want every businessman to shut up, and they're telling you, if you raise your voice, if you have an opinion, I'm going to go after your business.
So businessmen are now discouraged from making up stuff out of whole cloth and just lying and fabricating stories. They're being discouraged from doing that, which is exactly what happened in Nazi Germany, right, Mona?
Yeah. Also, what they wore a lot of masks in Nazi Germany. Yep. I think we learned from the Georgia lady. But people who want to make you do horrible things. You can't tell people straight out, you know, I want you to do something terrible. I want you to do something bad. They always have to frame it as you're only punching back. You're the victim here. You're only defending yourself. Yeah. Because nobody wants to see themselves as the bad guy. And so, you know, they are portraying this Lindell character as a victim and themselves as victims and so on. And let me just say another word about the courts, because it underscores something that Jonathan Rauch has been arguing very eloquently about. And I was very impressed with his book, The Constitution of Knowledge. I think everyone should read it. But one of the things that he points out is that, you know, there are a few realms of life that are sort of based upon not accusations, not somebody told me the NSA is listening, but actual proof. And the courts are one of those places. And we cannot emphasize too often the fact that every single lawsuit that was brought regarding the so-called stolen election failed because there was no evidence. And all of these conservative Republican judges, some of them appointed by Donald Trump, said, nope, no evidence. And, we have to constantly remember that method of attaining, of ascertaining whether something is true or not is really critical to a functioning society. One side gets to present its evidence, the other side gets to present opposing evidence, and then you decide on the relative merits of the case. When Rudy Giuliani was taking one of these cases to a court of appeals, I think he was asked, "Well, are you alleging fraud?" And in a courtroom, he had to say, "Well, no, Your Honor, we're not alleging fraud." You know, and then it was like, "Well, what are we doing here?" Right.
No, this is an important point. If there's one bright spot, it would be that. So I want to come back to the elections in just a moment. Have you noticed though that 90% of some of this right-wing pro-Trump media commentary involves claims that they are not allowed to say this, they are being silenced, they're being told to shut up. And of course, they're saying that their voices are being silenced on Fox News or on cable television. I mean, this is the thing is, nobody is saying to shut up. They're just saying, you know, if you're a liar, you're going to be held accountable for it. But this playing of the victim card has become, it's absolutely completely reflexive. It's so much so that, you know, that you have people, you know, people like Ben Shapiro, who is trending on, you know, Facebook and every social media metric you could possibly imagine, constantly whining about, you're not allowed to say blank, which he is saying. It's like, freaking said it. Okay.
Okay. All right. Which, and it is, I mean, sorry, but it is bullshit. Okay, fine. But But I also, you know, my both sides hat, put on my both sides hat. Mm. Look, I mean, there is a phenomenon, no question, out there in the world that people do resent, which is being told constantly that the terms are changing and that you have to say the right words or you're committing a microaggression. And so that is the atmosphere in which claims like this get some traction.
Well, that's right. And this is where people like you and I get in trouble, because we actually try to engage in a little bit of nuance and say, okay, here's something that is happening, which is real, but this reaction is extreme and unwise.
Well, exactly. You know,
there's a limited amount of tolerance for that sort of thing. Okay, so let's go back to the election lies, which are out there. And as you point out, not a single court anywhere in the world has given any validity to these charges, which have, you know, taken on the status of urban legends. And of course, we haven't even seen the worst of it yet, because we haven't gotten the results from that fake audit in Arizona, which they are trying to replicate in state after state after state. So this is going to be the stab in the back myth that will, since we're all doing 1930s, 1920s analogies, that is going to shape American politics for the next generation. I mean, I'm sorry, it's not going to go away. It's not going to be refuted. For, you know, 20 years from now, there will be people out there who will be sitting at the bar explaining why Donald Trump really won the election in 2020. But this is why I'm a little bit cranked up about what's going on in New York City. Okay, so yeah. People are going, wait, Charlie, what's your segue? Have you noticed, by the way, that already Donald Trump has issued a statement saying, see, if New York City can screw up its elections, maybe that means that we should look at the 2020 election. Nobody really knows. You got people like Charlie, you know, Kirk out there shit posting, saying, yep, if New York City can inadvertently count 135,000 ballots, what could that tell us about ballots counted in Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Arizona? So you know that that's going to happen. I mean,
except they didn't count them,
No.
I mean, this was a preliminary report about how the vote counting was going in the first ranked choice voting primary in New York. And they issued a preliminary report that they say, whoops, that was not right. We had accidentally included these sample ballots. Okay, so they didn't count them. They almost counted them, but then they caught their error. So that's not nothing. Yeah. I mean, it is different. I mean, obviously, it's not good. It will. A lot of people won't hear the explanation, and they will only hear that there was a mistake, and it will contribute to all the conspiracy theories about how elections are fraudulent. But
we should back up a little bit and assume that people are living their lives, and the New York City mayor's election is probably not top of mind for most people if you don't live in New York City. But they're using ranked choice voting. This is actually a very high profile test of a really good idea. So this is the other thing that's got me. Ranked choice voting is a good thing. I'm in favor of it, but I'm afraid it's going to be discredited by this. But so that they actually are using it in the mayoral primary, the first round, first choice votes. Eric Adams, who is a African-American he's a current police captain, former police captain, moderate, had a pretty strong lead, nearly 10-point lead in the election. People assumed that meant that he was going to win the nomination. What happened yesterday was New York City Elections Board then reported the second choices as you go through ranked choice voting, which we can explain in a moment. And that lead almost completely disappeared down to about 2 percentage points. Over a woman named Garcia, who would be a good mayor. But in any case, people were really shocked, you know, that the election result might have been so dramatically changed. But then came all of these discrepancies and the walkbacks. And then they started saying, okay, this doesn't look right. And then by 10:30 last night, they released a statement saying that they had failed to remove sample ballot images used to test the ranked choice voting software. So they ran these test results, producing 135,000 basically non-existent votes, at least in that preliminary report. And everybody's going, oh my God. And New York City Elections Board, I mean, they've been dysfunctional and they've had charges of nepotism and incompetence. This is what's really frustrating to me. You know, well, number one, I think it's going to really damage ranked choice voting unfairly. But at the moment when it seems so important to encourage confidence in the electoral process, we get this foobar for the ages out of New York City.
Right. And don't forget the FUBAR that happened in Iowa during the during the caucus last year. So there was that too. There are moments, aren't there, where you start thinking, you know, we're not very competent anymore, are we? But then again, that's uncharitable. The fact is they're trying new technology. They're making mistakes. There are lots of places that already use ranked choice voting, by the way, Charlie, and have had no problems.
Right.
And yes. So we'll see. It may not be completely discrediting. We'll see. But I'm having Catherine Gale on my podcast next week.
Excellent.
Who is a proponent of what she calls final five voting, which is a little different from ranked choice, but it's a similar idea. And we'll hear all about it from her. But I'm, you know, there are a couple of things about it, that and sort of perhaps having nonpartisan primaries, but even if they're partisan, you eliminate, if you have ranked choice, it's less likely that somebody who has a, you know, fired up constituency of, say, 28% of the electorate can win because they get a plurality. It's more likely then that the candidates, knowing that they have to appeal to the voters of, you know, the other guy's voters, you want them to put you as number two. You're gonna moderate, and you're not gonna be quite as nasty. I'm just reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's The Team of Rivals.
Yeah.
And Abraham Lincoln, in seeking the nomination for the Republican Party's nomination for president in 1860, was up against a really strong field. And his strategy was be everybody's acceptable second choice, which worked for him.
Well, I think this is a good idea. But going back to my lizard brain here, I just sense the way it's going to play out. So, for example, if somebody raised the issue of ranked choice voting for my home state of Wisconsin today, the immediate response would be, oh, ranked choice voting like they used in New York, and how did that work out for them? I mean, you just know that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah, it's going to.
Plus, my lizard brain also tells me that people like simple rather than complicated. Simple is you vote for the person you want, the person who gets the most votes wins, done. As opposed to, let me explain to you this system where you vote for five people, and then we have this runoff thing. I don't know. Okay, so can I ask you about something else crazy I don't understand? Could you explain to me? Because Mona, you need to be my explainer here. Governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, is sending 50 National Guards troops to the border because, of course, that's what we have to do. But they're paid for by a private donor, this billionaire fat cat Republican donor who is bankrolling the National Guard. So, I mean, are we kind of privatizing the military? What's going on? How do you do that? So a rich guy says, hey, you know what? I would like the military to do X. I'm going to find some right-wing or left-wing governor who is going to do my bidding. It's going to be right wing. And I'm just going to bankroll. I'm going to write you a check for $1 million and you send the troops here. Is that the new thing?
What could possibly go wrong? But before we get to that, Charlie, let's just pause on the idea of 50 National Guardsmen. There are 1,254 miles of border between Texas and Mexico. Just look that up. If you space them out, they should be able to do a lot of good at protecting the border. And besides, that's not their job. I mean, there are all kinds of legal limitations on how the military can be used domestically. There's the Posse Comitatus Act. There's all kinds of stuff besides this problem that you raise, which is, wait a minute, you know, a private donor is paying for this. Is that even legal? I'm not sure. I asked two lawyers last night at dinner. They weren't sure. But the idea that you could have private donors saying to governors, you know, I mean, imagine if, you know, somebody said, you know, how Republicans would react, rather, if some big liberal money man said, okay, I'm going to hire a team of investigators to go down to Texas and find out whether everybody has, you know, their guns legally or not, you know, or, you know, something along those lines. You know, there would be, of course, outrage, you know.
Okay. So can I put this through my lizard brain filter though?
Yeah.
Which Christy Noem understands. Okay. She fights.
Yeah.
Caravans.
That's right.
Immigrants. Mexican rapists coming for you. Send guys with guns. She fights. Okay, see? Yep. Winner. That's
that
it.
I have
who cares? Whatever it takes, by whatever means necessary.
And yeah, whether it's legal or not, that's a trivial consideration.
Okay, so speaking of legal or not, the House is voting, I think, today on creating this this January 6th committee that will be the select committee. This, of course, is after the bipartisan, independent, evenly balanced committee was killed by Republicans. It looks like this is going to go through on a party line vote. The Republican leadership in the House is actually whipping against it. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on all of this? Why Republicans are so adamant in not having a committee or a commission or any sort of investigation at this point to what happened on January 6th?
Because they're guilty.
Yeah.
They are pretty sure that they don't want the truth to come out. Mitch McConnell made it a point of personal friendship or you know, a personal request that members of the Senate, the Republican members of the Senate, vote against the idea of a commission. Because, you know, there were 8 Republican senators who voted to impeach? Was that it? Or 10? I don't remember. But
this is the problem of history. I thought it was 7, but okay.
Oh, maybe it was 7. Maybe it was 7. Yeah. Anyway, but, you know, those you might have thought would have been open to a commission at least. But McConnell, you know, big-footed it and said, no, please don't do this. And, you know, McConnell has no sense of no internal measure of right and wrong beyond what is good for the Republican Party. That's it. And so his view, we read that excerpt about what was happening with Bill Barr, right? And back in December of 2020, and Bill Barr and McConnell, according to this account by Jonathan Carl, had a series of conversations. You know, what the president is saying is crazy. That's right. Well, but McConnell says, I can't say that. Why? I need the president to go down and win those 2 Georgia Senate seats for us. And by the way, one of the people that he gave money to in Georgia was McConnell gave money to, that is, was, you know, Kelly Loeffler, who was campaigning with Marjorie Taylor Greene and repeating the big lie and promising to go to Washington and not certify the election. And so the idea that McConnell has clean hands here, no. They don't want the truth. They want to be able to rewrite history at their leisure. You know, it was Antifa. It never happened. They were nice tourists, whatever it is. It's a very, very bitter moment for people who thought that there was some integrity somewhere.
So, I've been pushing for Liz Cheney to be added to this commission, this committee. I think it's possible. Nancy Pelosi has made it clear that she is, well, at least she's suggested that she's, you know, open to having a Republican in one of the Democratic slots. I think Liz Cheney would be absolutely perfect. That won't stop Republicans from saying that this is a politicized witch hunt or a partisan witch hunt. I mean, no matter what they do, they're going to get the accusation anyway. So you might as well have your best, your brightest, your most forceful advocates out there. So I hope she does that.
Right. No, I agree. And don't forget that, you know, while MAGA world will say what it will say, there's a significant minority of the Republican Party, 20% maybe, that is open to argument and facts.
So I made a terrible mistake at the beginning of this podcast by activating my lizard brain because because now I'm seeing everything through that lens. And
the part, motto and part, of the day.
Well, and I think I've gone down a couple of levels here because I'm looking at the you know the whole issue of January 6th and wondering with this ongoing attempt to you know delegitimize the election, you know, getting even darker and more aggressive. At what point will MAGA World say, yeah, the problem with January 6th is that the they didn't succeed? You know, they were doing the right thing. It wasn't, it was, these were patriots who were trying to right a terrible wrong because basically that's what Donald Trump thinks. He hasn't articulated it that way, but given the trajectory, it's not impossible where we're going on all this. I'm sorry, that was too lizardy. Oh, well, okay, since we're on the lizard thing, the Paul Gosar story. Okay, yeah. Now here's my question. I am old enough to remember when Republicans actually understood how to handle stuff like this. Remember Steve King from Iowa, who was this backbencher who was constantly saying racist things. And finally, he just crossed the line where he's saying white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization. How did that language become offensive? Mm-hmm. And back in that day, in the midst of time, Republicans, even the ones who looked the other way, said, okay, that's going too far, white nationalist, white supremacist. So they stripped, the Republicans, stripped him of his committee assignments, and then he lost in a primary. You know, but frankly, I don't want to be misunderstood here, but King's comments are actually seem kind of quaint compared to what Paul Gosar is doing. He's openly flirting with Holocaust deniers, these Nazi-adjacent guys like Nick Fuentes. Yesterday we found out that he was holding a fundraiser with Nick Fuentes, who is one of the so-called Groypers. I mean, this is not a subtle or ambiguous thing with Nick. I mean, this is a guy who's
Since when did Holocaust, making fun of the Holocaust, become unacceptable? Since when, I want to know.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's, and yet, I think the chances that Kevin McCarthy it will do anything about him are slim and none. I mean, they're just not going to do it. So this
Gosar does have the distinction though of being from a very large family. He's got something like 10 or 11 brothers and sisters, and they are all united in calling for him to be punished, to be kicked out of Congress. They think he's a danger to the Republic. It's an interesting family story.
It is, and these, of course, the people who know him the longest and the best.
Yes.
And they're all trying to tell America, this guy is nuts. He's terrible. Yes. We should expel him from Congress. He's our brother, whatever. But it certainly is an indication of how far and fast the Republican Party has fallen, that they're not able to look at a Paul Gosar and saying it is not in our interest to keep you in this tent. I mean, it's morally wrong and it's politically wrong to do that. And they will come to neither conclusion.
And you know, people like Lindsey Graham will say, well, you know, you can't win without those people. So we have to make our peace with them. That's what, you know, that's the logic of their recent positions.
So before we move on from the election, and I mentioned this before we started the podcast, it's interesting. You had a piece several weeks ago in the Bulwark saying that the one thing the Congress really needs to address when it's dealing with elections is the Electoral Count Act, this bizarre, badly written law from the 19th century that lets Congress, or at least opens the door to Congress, overturning the results of an election. And you wrote that in the Bulwark, and it's interesting how many other people have picked up on that since. It kind of feels like you got a little bit of a snowball going downhill, gathering a little bit of momentum as people realize that, you know, yes, the whole problem of how we cast votes is relevant, but right now the real danger is how we count those votes.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I mean, you can, on the one hand, you can recognize that what many Republican state legislatures are doing is being done in bad faith. They are attempting to limit the vote from constituencies that they think won't support them and whatever. Okay. That's not good. But the fact is, the real urgent danger is what we came close to, what Donald Trump was urging upon the Congress in 2020, which is in 2021, rather, in January, which is to use their power to decertify election results from states where it went the other way. And unfortunately, the Electoral Count Act is such a hot mess that it isn't entirely impossible that this could happen, so that you could have a Republican Congress failing to acknowledge the votes of, say, you know, let's say Michigan goes for the Democrat, the Republican Congress could say, well, we think there were we think there was fraud in Michigan, so we're not accepting Michigan's slate of delegates and of electoral college votes, and we're going to disallow them. And, you know. And here's the thing, though: people say, "Well, okay, you want to reform the Electoral Count Act, but why won't Republicans just filibuster that too?" And so my answer to that is: first of all, they might, but it would be harder for them because their rationale for all of these voting changes that they're making in the states is that they're guarding against fraud, right? That they are trying to, you know, make sure that there's a voter ID component requesting absentee ballots so that, you know, ballot harvesting will be more difficult, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you and I have talked, I think, before about, you know, that the Democrats should not die on the hill of voter ID. It's broadly popular, including with Democrats and minorities. And it's not something that Democrats should make a big fuss about. And similarly, by the way, I think that a lot of the attention about, oh, you know, they're trying to limit how much water you can give somebody, or whether you can give somebody water while waiting in line to vote. Honestly, who cares, right? Don't make that the big issue. Bring your own water. The issue is changing the Electoral Count Act to make sure that a badly motivated Congress cannot easily, as it currently can, dismiss the votes of the Electoral College. Right now, it just takes one congressman and one senator to object to the count from any delegate from any state. So increase that, you know, make it 2/3 of those present or whatever. Similarly, it now takes a majority, make it to disallow the votes from a state. The one senator, one congressman was to consider it, right, and then they have to go to their separate bodies. But you know, increase that to a supermajority. Take the wisdom of the Constitution, apply it here, and clarify all of these rules that are unbelievably opaque in this horrible piece of legislation. And it will be harder for Republicans to argue that this is something that is just increasing Democrats' power, right? We'll see. But
no, I think this is and legal experts have long said that law is just badly drafted. It's incoherently drafted. The history of the law is, as we say, at minimum problematic. I actually think they will address this at some point, because I think the more people think about it, the more they'll recognize that this is crucial. Okay, can I talk about something that I have not actually mentioned at all? On the podcast, I've hardly mentioned it in my newsletter. I think I maybe have had one tweet about it, but I am thoroughly obsessed about it. This collapse of the condominium down in Surfside, Florida. It is such a terrible tragedy. It is so horrible. It is so incomprehensible to me how something like this happened, how building codes and building inspections did not catch the problem, why repairs weren't made. There's so much about this that bothers me, that buildings like this should not fall down in the United States of America. And if this one fell down, then it's not the only one that's on the brink down. I honestly do not understand, parenthetically, I don't understand the people in the adjacent condos who have not realized that you need to get out now. Go. So yeah. Any thoughts about this? Because I mean, it just seems like a failure on so many different levels. It just feels like a competence failure, an engineering failure, a political failure, a failure of responsibility, a failure on the part of the condo board.
All of the above. Yeah. I mean, you know, and it is mind-boggling. This is the kind of thing that you see happening in China. You know, there were buildings that collapsed because they were thrown up really carelessly, and rail, you know, trains have gone off bridges because of poor construction in China, and they left a whole trainload of people who had fallen into a ravine. They left them there because they couldn't reach it to pull the bodies out. So you know, you think of that kind of thing happening in countries that are dysfunctional, that are poorly run, that don't have checks and balances. You know, whenever you do anything in your home, I'm sure it's the same in Wisconsin. I mean, we just put a awning in the roof over our backyard to get some shade. Anyway, you've got to get a permit. You've got to get the county to come over and make sure it's okay and it's not going to fall down, and you know that the contractor is certified and licensed, and on and on and on. We have all these things for a reason, so that you don't have horrible tragedies like what happened in Miami. And it's just mind-boggling that everything had to fail here. The inspections, everything had to fail. The government, the private sector, everything.
It is so horrible. Okay, so in my mind, I connected some dots here, and I'm not sure that it's justifiable, but that's the way, you know, that's just the way it goes. You know, the question of what is a conservative, what is not a conservative, which has become very tedious because I think that the term conservative almost means nothing anymore, except loyalty to Trump. But being a conservative does not mean that we don't repair infrastructure. I mean, is that clear? I mean, honestly, it's because I'm thinking about the infrastructure bill, and I don't want to get into the quagmire of the negotiations about this, but building things and fixing bridges and replacing roads does not strike me as radical socialism. It strikes me as the thing that any prudent country does. We used to invest in the country. We built the transcontinental, you know, railroad. We built the interstate highway system. These were not partisan issues in any way. Now, I'm not endorsing everything in the Biden infrastructure package, but what is the conservative position on infrastructure? I would think that not updating infrastructure, not making repairs, not making investments is not conservative at all. And yet, in the minds of some folks, just being against everything is the only legitimate conservative position.
The Republican position is, if the Democrats are for it, we're against it.
Yeah.
that's pretty much it. Although, you know, perhaps there would be enough Republicans who would say, vis-a-vis the first infrastructure bill where they announced a deal on the compromise bill, you know, who there are enough people who would want to cut ribbons and take credit for, you know, bringing jobs and bringing construction to their communities and so on. And by the way, Charlie, just on the subject of, you know, what's the conservative view on infrastructure? You know, I don't know anybody who thought of themselves as being conservative who didn't make the distinction in the past between what governments borrow money for, right? I mean, to borrow money to win World War II, well, that's an important thing to do. To borrow money to improve your roads, bridges, airports, all of those infrastructure things that will then have benefits going down into the future and help your economy thrive, that's a very good use of borrowed money. A less good use of borrowed money is to just send checks to people. For that, you should find the money elsewhere. But, you know, or at least that was the case that we used to make. But, you know, look, I actually think in this case, and I think he acknowledged it, that Biden made a mistake, that he should have just accepted the compromise, which would have been a big win for him, is a big win for him and for what he is trying to convey to the voters, namely, I can get things done. And it would have, you know, Republicans would have been able to, you know, say, well, I brought jobs to my district or infrastructure to my district, and they would have gotten something too. Everybody would have walked away happy. It would have ratified the notion that we are not so dysfunctional and polarized that we can't do anything anymore. And so it would have been great. And unfortunately, he did make that mistake, which he rapidly tried to correct. But he made that mistake of saying, no, we're going to link it to the other infrastructure, which is the so-called human infrastructure, which is a whole other thing, which the left wing of his party very much wants. And, you know, look, I'm not passing judgment as to whether that spending would be a good idea or a bad idea, but he really needed to just take the win.
Right, you know? Right. And this was a blunder, and I mentioned this yesterday. And the specific blunder was saying that he would veto the bill that he just endorsed if he didn't get the other thing. That kind of linkage was the bridge too far. Obviously, they're going to pursue a two-track plan. And the reality is that progressives will get a lot of what they wanted in the reconciliation bill, but they won't get everything. But so it's going to be interesting to see whether or not the left wing of the party is willing to scuttle the Biden presidency, because, you know, Biden is now, you know, between these two vices. I mean, obviously, Mitch McConnell will do everything possible to derail his presidency to stop this. But also there is that wing of the party, the progressive wing of the party, that will not, you know, that for whom the perfect is the enemy of the good. And we'll see how pragmatic or how ideological they are here.
Well,
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and the Democratic Party has, famously has many more factions, many more rooms than the Republican Party at the moment. And you do have a struggle going on between people like James Clyburn, who I give a lot of credit for the fact that Joe Biden was the nominee in 2020 and basically saved America. Thank you, James Clyburn. But between people like him, who he's a longtime congressman, African American, he is a moderate. He's against, as he says, you know, he has condemned the left wing of the party, the progressives, for their what he calls sloganeering, things like defund the police. He said, you know, in the 60s, I was against burn, baby, burn, and now I'm against defund the police. It's not what I support. It's not what my constituents want, and it's harmful to the party. And then there's the AOC wing, and they have a lot of support. So it's interesting to watch that play out. And of course, I know which side I'm on.
So the story about Jim Clyburn is very interesting. I'm really glad you brought this up, because he is the number three ranking Democrat in the House of Representatives. And I think obviously played a central, if not the central, role in the nomination of Joe Biden to be president.
Yep.
James Clyburn has done something kind of unusual. He has made an endorsement in an Ohio congressional race to head off the candidacy of a supporter, a really close, ideological acolyte of Bernie Sanders. And he said, this is a direct quote, "When I spoke out against sloganeering like burn, baby, burn in the 1960s and defund the police, which I think is cutting the throats of the party, I know exactly where my constituents are. They are against that, and I am against that." So he's willing to take a stand against what he sees as politically damaging elements in his own party in the way that Republicans, I think, have not been willing to do sometimes.
In their own party, right, exactly. Exactly.
But it is interesting the role that Clyburn is playing, because he brings a huge amount of credibility. I suppose you could say that he represents the Biden establishment in the party, but it does make you wonder how hot this internal civil war between the Biden wing of the party and the Bernie wing of the party might become, and whether it might actually manifest in votes. I guess I'm scared every time I bring this up. I am reassured by people who say, "Charlie, you need to understand that the Democrats are much more pragmatic, that in the end they will do the right thing." But the margins are so thin, particularly in the House of Representatives, it does not take more than a handful of folks in the House to blow up this whole thing. So I don't know. This is a stay tuned. I sort of get the sense that everybody right now is just positioning. Everybody is obviously, you know, laying down their markers. And so in some ways, they're doing their job. They're doing what they're supposed to do. And it doesn't mean necessarily that it's going to blow up. But boy, it's if Biden pulls this off, it will be one of the most impressive legislative victories that I can recall. And I say that advisedly, because, I mean, when you look back at other major legislative victories by presidents, they did it with huge, comfortable majorities. It's really much what Biden has to do is thread the needle in the most acrobatic possible way, like threading a needle while walking across a tightrope above a river of alligators. I mean, it's like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and you know, do you remember at the end of the campaign last year, there was a lot of talk on conservative sites and so forth saying, you know, I may just have to vote for Trump because, you know, even though he has his faults and everything, boy, the Democrats are crazy and they're so extreme. And if we vote for Biden, then we're going to get, you know, Puerto Rico as a state and we're going to get the end of the filibuster and we're going to get, what else did they worry about? I don't remember. But anyway, they have a long list.
Packed the Supreme Court.
Packed Supreme Court, right. And at the time, I remember, you know, sort of stroking my chin and saying, have they looked at the U.S. Senate? I mean, the Democratic members of the U.S. Senate are not AOC types. I mean, there are quite a few. Well, there's Bernie Sanders, of course.
Yeah.
But there are quite a few, not just Manchin and Sinema. There's the Delaware guy whose name escapes me right
this
second.
Right?
Chris Coons.
Yes, not at all.
There are so many others who are, you know, letting Manchin sort of take the lead because of the nature of his state and so forth. But they also don't want to blow up the filibuster. They also have their hesitations about the agenda of the progressive wing of the party. So, you know, I was always skeptical that there was going to be this rush to enact all kinds of extreme measures because the Democratic caucus in the Senate is not that leftist. There's Bernie, yeah, but there aren't that, and there are a few others, but it's a mix.
It's very much a mix, and so is the House caucus. And unfortunately, as I've said many times, we don't hear as much about Abigail Spanberger as AOC, and yet she has just as much, you know, in many ways is just as influential within that caucus.
And Abigail Spanberger types are the way for the Democrats to hold power, and they just the progressives don't want to accept that, but that's the reality because that's the nature of the country.
It is.
If they had a lot more Abigail Spanbergers, then they wouldn't have this razor thin margin in the House.
And she's the kind who's most endangered by the defund the police rhetoric.
It is
people like her and Connor Lamb who, in fact, are on that razor's edge. And if, in fact, there is going to be a Republican wave, they will be the most vulnerable. So, Mona Chern, what else are you looking at this week? What are you thinking about? What should we be paying attention to?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm still looking at this critical race theory stuff and reflecting that it is, despite what people say, it's not new. I went back and looked at a bunch of columns I'd written decades ago. And you actually looked at, didn't you pull up a book of yours from a long time ago? And
yes,
some of these arguments that we've been having forever.
I did a screenshot of a book that I published in 1990. So, you know, for these people who say, well, you don't understand what you're talking about. You and I, Mona, I'm sorry, we have been writing about this for decades.
Yes.
We were writing about this before Christopher Rufo was born. I know, that sounds like old people, but really, this stuff
and
is-
And get off my lawn.
No, well, I mean, so I understand the arguments against it. I have made the arguments against it. The problem is, once again, watching these arguments taken over by, you know, demagogues and charlatans who completely distort it and turn it into something else. And I know that you're going to be talking with on your podcast Beg to Differ, you're going to be talking with historian Ron Radosh. Is that how you pronounce the name? I'm sorry.
Radosh. That's fine.
You know, who is very, very familiar with you know, demagogues like, for example, David Horowitz. And on my newsletter yesterday, I quoted from a fundraising letter that I'd gotten from David Horowitz last fall, where he's warning about, you know, Sharia law and Islam in the schools. And it's, you know, again, okay, buried in there might be a nugget of something to be concerned about, but it is the extreme, shrill panic porn that we're seeing on the right. And my point was that Horowitz's, you know, screed about how they're taking God out of the schools and putting Islam in the schools is pretty much exactly the same playbook as we're seeing with critical race theory. There's a lot of problems with critical race theory, and I have written about them, and you have written about them extensively. But the way that it's simply being used as a cudgel and distorted and fudged by, you know, some of these folks is problematic. Not to mention the attack on free expression, free speech, and academic freedom that apparently the right has decided that they're okay with. By the way, have you noticed how the whole cancel culture, I mean, cancel culture has, they've dropped it apparently, at least temporarily, because they're engaging in it?
Cancel culture is terrible. Now, make sure that nobody can say anything about critical race theory.
Well, yes. Cancel. We stand against cancel culture. And by the way, we need to cancel this Olympic athlete who turned her back on the flag and she needs to be kicked out. I mean, yeah. And they do it without like taking a breath. There's no pause between it. It's just like, guys, I'm sorry. I need to go back to my lizard brain to understand how this all works. Mona Charon, thank you so much for joining me on today's podcast. Make sure you check out Beg to Differ, which is Mona's podcast, comes out every Friday. This week should be very, very interesting. Mona, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much, Charlie. Great to be with you.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.